Help us, Google Fiber. You're our only hope. Episode 125 of the Furler Bros Tech Podcast.
Welcome to episode 125 of the Furlough Bros Tech Podcast. Today is February the 15th, 2014. I'm Matthew Dean Furlough, and this is my love-struck brother, James Furlough.
Have you ever watched the YouTube version of this podcast?
Yes. Once.
So then you know that it doesn't actually show the two little boxes that you and I see. It just shows the main screen.
Yes. Okay. So all that dancing
for me.
Every single week. I do that knowing that you're the only person that sees it. It's sort of like a little bit of a. It's like a. What I really like is I know Keegan knows that. You know, like he obviously doesn't because I don't play that music for him when we do. Whatever. It's besides the point. It's just for you. I'm a nice brother like that. It's my gift.
Good Valentine's gift.
You're welcome. Did you have a good Valentine's Day?
Yeah. What did we do? I don't know. We watched some I Hate Valentine's Day, I think was the name of the movie last night on Netflix.
Nice.
And it had a lot of the same characters, or the two main characters from My Big Fat Greek Wedding.
Hmm.
But you could tell they did it on like a tenth of the budget.
Oh, yeah.
So it was kind of weird and goofy, but it was good. It was good.
Nice.
Super predictable, like most movies are nowadays, but that's all right.
I went and saw The Little Mermaid.
Oh.
It's they've released it on digital and Blu-ray and stuff, so it's that and The Jungle Book. So doing like this special engagement at my local theater. So it's like $5. You get to go and see The Jungle Book or The Little Mermaid. And Little Mermaid was up on the docket last night, so we went. And I got to be honest, dude. It's a fantastic movie. Me and our cousin Timmy. It was kind of like two 20, 27-year-old dudes in the movie theater watching Little Mermaid and like a bunch of kids and 15-year-old girls judging us and just like, you know, moms and stuff. It was like, well, you know, like, what are you two doing here? Like, dude, we're stockholders, I think, or maybe, you know. we're like the Little Mermaid, okay? So whatever.
Yeah, you're right. And I think Abu the Monkey's hilarious too.
Yeah, well, see, we didn't get to see.
Oh, wait, you're right. That's the wrong movie.
Yeah,
I'm thinking of
Aladdin?
The Candle and the Clock Guys. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. I know. What is wrong with you? You know what's really weird to think about? That, so you've got.
P.S. I totally knew I was saying the wrong movies, just for the record.
I know. I appreciate it. Okay. That's why I'm.
That wasn't for you.
You let that linger. I was going to say, you know what's crazy to think about? This is what's nuts to me. Okay, so you know how you got The Little Mermaid, and think about the time frame of, like, when that was coming out, like, what the world was like, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now think about this. It was only 3 years later that Toy Story came out. I don't know why, but I was like, I have it in my brain that, like, because there are these animated movies, they're all, like, old. I don't, you know, it's like, they're not of the modern era, and because Toy Story is all CG, I have this, like, mindset that, you know, it's new, it's of the modern era. But the fact that they're, like, there's only 3 years of bridging them. Little Mermaid was 89, Toy Story was 92. It's like, whoa. Whoa. Yeah, it's
because crazy. And then they had a pretty good run, right? Where they did it was Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, Lion King. And
right.
Then they kind of went off the rails with Pocahontas, right?
Yeah, something
like
that.
Kind of the order.
I think that's so. I'm I'm an expert on many things, James, but that exact order, I am not the expert on.
Well, there was a cool, what was it? Man, I can't remember, honestly, if it was Little Mermaid or Beauty and the Beast. I feel like it was Beauty and the Beast. But what happened was, and this was in the special features for it, where they were talking about how you had, like, Disney had animators, obviously, and, you know, they had done some amazing work, right? You think in Snow White, Bambi wasn't that great, but you had Snow White and Cinderella, and I feel like there was one other one there that I'm forgetting about, but, these animators who had done these feature-length films who were, you know, quite literally pioneers in the animation industry, right? Yeah. And then they took a little break, and then they kind of got back to it. And they said what happened was they had a whole bunch of new people, animators, in there, and they had all these older animators there. And they said, and they just kind of put them all together in this big room and said, okay, we're going to make another movie. It's going to be called Little Mermaid. And, you know, and they were just like, they go, it was amazing. And they were just talking about how much fun it was to work together and how you had all these guys who were like highly skilled, had a ton of experience, were amazing at their job. And then you had, you know, the guys with just a ton of energy and the creative juices were just flowing like crazy. And so they said they produced some of like just amazing, amazing movies. And they also talked about how, you know, the music obviously plays a huge role.
Yeah.
Huge role. And I forget who the guy was, because he got cancer pretty young in life, and so he died early. And he was the guy who wrote all the songs. Yeah. And, you know, and he was the one who was like, you know, if we have a lot of explaining to do about something, we'll just sing it in a song, and we can do it really fast. And so he came up with that concept. And
pretty funny.
Yeah, and, you know, and so that's why all their songs, like, they're not just, you know, like a classic musical. They're singing, they're dancing. It doesn't really move the story forward.
Yeah.
Whereas with Disney, it moves the story forward. You don't get bored because they're telling you what's happening through song. Yeah. And that was the guy who...
Montage!
Yeah. And so he was the guy who came up with that idea. And then I believe they did the same thing for Beauty and the Beast, and which is why it's just one of those best movies ever type things.
Right.
And then Disney decided that they wanted to go to an every, because they were doing that like every other year, and they decided they wanted to do an every year release date. And so what they did, split the teams in two. So they had one team work on one project for 2 years, and then they somehow, you know, they took a break, and then another team worked on a project for 2 years so they could do an every year release cycle. And so they split them up, and they just went, that was the end of a specific era, and they began a new era. And it sounds like at that same time, and it sounded like it was just timing, right?
Yeah.
Pixar was doing their thing. And P.S., by the way, like for the first 3 or 4 movies, Pixar used that same model. Everyone is working on the same movie at the same time. We're not doing, you know, and so that was why Toy Story came out, and it seemed like it was like 3 years before another movie came out. And it was, yeah, that's how long it
Right, and it really wasn't until Toy Story 2 that they, you know, you got the first round of, the team was broken up, and what's his name, the dude who...
Lasseter.
Lasseter wasn't in charge of it. They let Lasseter watch it once, and Lasseter was like, Jobs is gonna kill us all, we need to make this better. And then Lasseter started to, you know, pick apart little pieces of it, trying to remake it subtly so it wouldn't be awful, and then ended up completely remaking it, and it was arguably better. It's funny. I mean, you take Lasseter's body of work and you go, obviously he's a genius. When you take specific stories like Toy Story 2 and sort of like how that all evolved, you're just like, yeah, he's smart. He's talented.
Well, yeah, and is it any surprise that, you know, he oversaw the movie Frozen and helped write that?
Not at all.
Oh, yeah, and so I look at that, and it was like, I wish I could remember this guy's name. I just don't. That music guy. It's just amazing how all it takes is one or two people to completely change the direction and the outcome of something and to make it something special.
It's funny to bring this back around to the tech industry. I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, I've always been if you're on this show, I've always said I really think that, you know, Apple was more than one man, and it had, you know, it wasn't a one man show, and putting all the emphasis on Steve Jobs was wrong. There were things that he was brilliant at, but he was not the only person there. You know, Tim Cook was a big part of that. You know, Johnny Ives is a huge part of what makes Apple brilliant. And you know, just, you know, these different, you know, Schiller and this guy and that guy, and like, you just like, it's an entire team. It wasn't a one man show. And then you have stories like that where you're like, I mean, it was Jobs found Lasseter, and Lasseter made it great. You know, and what do you want us to do with Toy Story? Make it great. You're like, what the heck is that?
Jobs
didn't
find Lasseter, but
that's a good point. Because Lasseter was already working for. Technically, Lucas found him, right?
The timing was pretty close on that.
Yeah, I
don't think so. They didn't. Jobs owned Pixar by the time Lexo Lamp came out, and one of Jobs' gifts was the ability to see genius in someone.
Yeah.
And go, you need to do more.
Yeah,
you know, and I mean, they were even like, this is a fun, super fun story. I read a biography, listened to a biography about Pixar a year ago. Man, really? Nah. Yeah, almost. Maybe 9 months ago. Anyways, so I listened to this. Yeah, because we were fixing up our duplex, and I remember listening to it. Okay, I'm back. They were talking about how they were trying to make computers, you know, computer graphic type stuff, and that was why Jobs bought it to create another hardware business to kind of hedge on Next.
Right.
And so on the side, they were like, we need to somehow show the capabilities of these computers and what they can do. And so it was one of the other manager folks connected with Lasseter because he wanted to do a Brave Little Toaster using CG with Disney. And he wanted to tell the story in a
Lasseter made Brave Little Toaster. Oh, my God.
No, he didn't make it. That was the problem. He wanted to, and Disney wouldn't let him tell the story the way that he wanted to tell it because it was too edgy or something like that. And, you know, and so – and he wanted to push the bounds of the art style, like using 3D art. And they're just like, no, that we're not that kind of company. And so I don't remember if he got fired or you know, he – left on mutual terms, but you know, he just did not get along well with the Disney folks at all, and so he left. Yes, later on Disney did make Brave Little Toaster, and from what I understand, it's nothing like what he actually had in mind, which is interesting.
It's still a beloved movie and one of the most terrifying kids movies of all time.
I know, right? Right? So I'm sure that was part of their, you know, I'm sure there's part of it that was from that. But anyways, so he came and his job was to like try to, you know, help prove the technology. And they couldn't hire like an animator. And so he was a computer technician kind of thing. And, you know, helping to test the software out. Yeah, he's like, yeah, I wasn't officially an animator. And so he had to learn how to program and how to do all this. And they decided to – he made that Luxo Lamp movie, and they shared it with Jobs, and he was like, oh, well, that's cool. He liked it, and they ended up – they shared it to whatever, the Sundance Film Festival or, you know, one of those short film festivals.
Yeah.
And, you know, won like crazy. And everyone says, like, the insight wasn't the fact that the graphics were amazing. It was just – somehow he had imputed these human characteristics onto a lamp, and you know, and you connect.
It's just, yeah.
I mean, it's classic him, right? I mean, that's what he's known for. And what I thought was interesting for him, he, you know, his whole like his thing, he, you know, his storytelling thing is you have something. That he goes, you have a natural state, which works really well with toys. You know, toys like to be played with, was his example.
Yeah.
you know? And he goes, and so give them their natural state and then take that away from them or threaten it. And then just see how would you react if you didn't get that anymore? And yeah. I mean, that's the Toy Story, you know, storyline right there.
Right. That, yeah, it's plus, I mean, yeah. It's and I mean, what I love about all of this is that I just love the brilliance of the creative process and that sort of thing. Cause it's, you know, as oftentimes the greatest stories that have ever been written are incredibly simple. They're just, they're there are stories that are wonderful in their complexity, but there are stories that, you know, on the flip side, some of the most, you know, some of my favorite, most brilliant stories are just, we did one thing and just asked the question, like you said, what happens now? How do they react to this? You know, we're not trying to make anything, you know, and it just flows naturally. But what I love about this almost, and this is, you know, and to just bring it back around a little bit.
Yeah.
It was the guy in charge realized that what he bought, what George Lucas was buying, was what George Lucas built, was a tool to make Star Wars type movies. What Steve Jobs bought was a graphics based company to, you know, to help with his operating system company. And what it became was a tool for a brilliant artist. And Steve Jobs said, okay. You know, it was just like,
yeah.
And that's, you know, and that, and it's, and that, that, you know, like, you know, when they talk about what Steve Jobs was great at, it was, they've always said it's, you could just, he could be completely wrong and be all right with it. And he'd think he was right all the time. And that's a perfect example of what you lose is, A, like you said, the insight into brilliance, just the fact that he looked at people and he could see people who were brilliant and just pulled more out of them. And I think in general, he pulled more out of everybody. And so he just highlighted, if you had a little brilliance, he made you seem really smart, you know, even more brilliant because, you know, because he could pull it out of you. If you were actually a genius, he could make you just, you know, legendary. And then the other thing that he does, and that, they, you know, he's legendarily, you know, this is what everybody says, is that whole idea of he bought the company for the wrong reason. He did, you know, he's got this company, he's got this new product, and he's just like, yeah, sure, we'll become a movie company. What? That's not what this is, you know.
And they talk about how, like, they do board meetings where they'd have to ask him for tons of money because they were losing money hand over fist.
Yeah.
And they always felt so bad about it. And he was always super critical. And then they get done and be like, "So, when's the next short coming out? Can I see it yet?" You know. And so he always just had this, like, you know, he didn't like how the company was going. And then this one, they were always like, "Yeah, he liked it." You know, which just meant he could tell something was there. And they were like, "Should we invest more?" He's like, Not yet. Let's feel it out. And I don't remember if Disney approached Pixar or the other way around. They probably, Pixar was like, you know, we could make a feature length film. And they went, yeah, but we can't afford it. And that was where Jobs went to bat and, you know, did all the hard negotiating. But I think this is also, you know, this points out why we spent so much time talking about Satya Nadella at Microsoft last week, because, like, that's critically important. He is in a role where he's going to have to identify those people, identify that genius, and go, you know what, you're onto something. I may not fully understand it, and 3-5 years from now, it may look completely different, but there's something about that I like. Right. Keep going. I'm going to put you in charge of something. I'm going to give you some money to explore it, and let's see where that goes. Mm-hmm. And I mean, and that's the fun part about, you know, what we do and why we like looking at startups, and because, you know, they're onto something. They, you know, they've seen something. We don't always fully understand what it is, and sometimes it, you know, it doesn't last very long. You know, I don't know if you've noticed, but there haven't been like any articles about Snapchat recently. They kind of went big time, and now it's. I'm sure they're still doing fine.
Yeah,
but yeah, the infatuation with that's gone. So, anyways. Yeah.
You know,
so
and it's funny.
I agree with you that Little Mermaid was a great movie and a great example of, you know, just a great product that touches people's hearts.
And yeah, thank you for bringing it back around. Because, I mean, because this week, like every week, we'll be talking about technology and the continuing corporate opera. But what we love about it, and it's funny, I hope every once in a while we dive into a little bit of why this is our opening statement, what it is about the corporate opera, because this is what's fascinating. It's the people involved in it. It's their dramas. It's how it's how they interact. It's, you know, when we say this, you know, the corporate opera, we talk about the soap opera of corporations, what, you know, how they're all interrelated, the people working for them, because like you said, that's critically important. Their marketing campaigns, because that's how they convey themselves to us. And, you know, and then lastly, and, you know, excitingly, but really lastly, the actual products they're making, because, you know, and I hope that if there's anything different about our show, that announcing new products and asking sales figures, those are all really secondary to the creative process and the relationships that are being built and understanding the foundations of how these things work, because, you know, you can get product announcements from anybody. Understanding how they fit into the larger ecosystem of all these companies and therefore where they've been, where they're going, that I'm hoping is our brilliance. We'll let you decide.
but right.
Yeah, so before we do get into the heart of the show, which I know it feels like we're already there, James has got a short disclosure he's got to throw our way.
I work for HP, but do not represent HP or any of HP's opinions. Not as important this week, will become super important next week.
What's going on next week?
HP is releasing a product today that I'm going to wait until next week to talk about.
Oh, okay, cool. Coo-coo-coo-choo.
Because I kind of want to see everyone else's reviews first.
Before you chime in. It's amazing. Everybody's like, it's terrible. I mean,
because I'm super biased. Because I've been working on it for like a year. So.
Yeah. That'll be that. You know what? Yeah. I feel you. I hope it. You know what? I'll take a measured approach when I look at it in a week when I get back from Spain. If you want to follow us throughout the week, you know, check out our you know, what we're doing in the social media world. My Twitter is at Matthew D. Furlow. My Instagram is Next Week in 4. This is a good week to be following me because, as I just mentioned, I'm going to be in Spain, which means I'll have all sorts of cool pictures that try to they're not called selfies. They're called braggies.
I love those.
I'm in Spain, everybody. Would you like my pictures? I live such a cool life. But seriously, I have a pretty cool life.
How many hours do you leave?
I am going.
How many hours?
My flight is at 3:30. I got to be at Espo at 1:30, which means I got to leave here.
Yeah, ton of time.
I got to leave here at 12:30, which means I'm gonna have to be eating lunch with my ride at 11:30. So I've actually got not as much time as I'd like, but it is.
That happens.
What it is, yeah.
It's coming up fast. You can follow me, jamesfurlow.com. I will not be in Spain. My pictures will not be as cool. And you can also find me on Twitter, at jamesfurlow.
And if you want to go just and see all this information where everything's collated into one helpful resource, go to furlowbros.com. Not .guru, not .net, not .org, not .whatever, all the different top-level domains possible, but .com, the true top-level domain.
Record, we have referenced last week's show twice, so if you haven't listened to that, you really should.
Yeah, get on it. what was I going to say? Oh, on that website, on that brilliant website, we've got all sorts of cool resources about the show. All the articles that we talk about, brilliant articles, none of them we've talked about so far, but all the ones we're about to talk about, we link all those so that you can get all those resources yourself. Also, the link to the YouTube video that we talked about earlier, and link to the podcast, including the show cuts, shorter snippets of the show, and then make the whole thing a little bit more bite-sized if you can't handle a two-hour show. It's funny. Every time I talk to my friends, they're like, how long do you do the show for? I'm like, 2 hours. And they're like, wow, that's a really long time. I'm like, have you met me? Like, You really think that's a long time?
We were friends.
Yeah, exactly. but yeah, no. It's but if it's a little hard for you to handle, we understand. We get it. We've been told. and we're trying to make it convenient
don't
for
care.
You. Yes, exactly. We care
we're making
enough.
A product that we love, and we are desiring customers who love it just like we do.
Exactly. This is a premium product for premium
customers.
Yeah.
There you go.
Love it.
I read some book that was about attracting perfect customers at one time, but that was back when I cared about marketing. Oh, wait, I still do.
Uh-huh.
I still do.
All right. Let's do this.
Yeah.
So this is a good time of year. Do you ever follow the Crunchies?
You know, sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. This year I did not get to.
This was a year where I don't normally follow the Crunchies, and I don't know why, whatever, but I probably will follow it. Yeah, well, aren't all awards
made up?
Yeah, I was gonna say it's funny. We actually, you know, part of founding a fraternity is you get to make up the first round of awards, and it's really weird. Like years later, you know, it's because we're part of a national fraternity. Some of them are set out for us, but some of them are like the local ones. And like, it's funny talking, like, you know, it's been almost a decade now. And, like the new kids, like that are coming into the fraternity have no knowledge. They're like, to them, these just have always existed. And they're like, you know, I mean, like, these are, you know, they, and it's just, it's weird to see them look at awards as like these things that have always been, and they've like, they're, you know, these meaningful things. And we're like, dude, half of those were jokes. I can't believe you take them seriously. Like, what the heck?
That's funny.
But
that means we got to come up with some awards. We have to have an award show.
Dude.
Okay.
That's, you know what? You know what we really need to do? We need a completely off-season award show. Because everybody else, like July, like, you know, made it through the Christmas excitement awards. It's actually not a bad idea. But anyways.
Surviving summer. Okay, yeah, exactly. All right. Noodle on this.
Yeah, this is kind of...
Man, I wish we lived next to each other. We'd actually, like... it would be great. Oh, well. It is what it is.
You know what, James? Come on down. There's plenty of space.
If only there was a way that we could like do this virtually.
I know,
where
exactly.
Where it seemed like we were together.
Yeah, like there are all these companies that you'd think would be able to deliver something like that, but you know, whatever. So anyways,
you know, if there was like an award-winning company that could help us do that.
Exactly. Come on, guys. So the two
I'm really trying hard to set you up here.
I know, thank you. So the two that I thought you were talking about Google. I was like, you mean like Google Huddle? Like, yeah, that'd be awesome.
No.
The two there's two, number one, the opening monologue by John Oliver of Daily Show fame. Pretty funny. Just him ragging on the tech, on all these techies, just making fun of them was it's pretty golden. I mean, like, that's his thing. Like, he's just like, what is this? This is stupid. You're all dorks. Go away. And like, he kind of gets, it's funny. He kind of gets off into like the NSA, like privacy stuff. And it's like, this is just sad, John. Like, this isn't funny anymore. Like, this is terrible. And then he gets back into making fun of the tech people, like, that's right, you're so funny. but the two awards that I thought were most interesting or exciting, because I like them, was number one, best hardware startup goes to Oculus Rift. I'm so stoked for this company.
So they won an award even though they haven't started selling them yet.
Yeah, because they're a startup. Well, technically, they started selling, like, the dev kits. You can buy the dev kits.
And actually,
you want to know why I know this? Because I've gotten so excited about them in the last few weeks. I actually went to their website and was, like, looking at how much a dev kit costs and the different components you need. Was looking at my bank account. I was like, this is stupid. What are you doing?
Wow.
Stop it. And
just out of curiosity, what's the approximate cost to get in on that?
$200 for the hardware for just the Oculus Rift,
which is not bad.
Which is why
Glasses will call you $1,500 from Google.
Which is why I was pretty tempted. But the problem is all it is really and truly is a monitor, a $200 monitor. You need a game. You need a piece of hardware, a rig that can do the rendering. So if you want to play like the 3D games and stuff, you need a hardcore computer. And I have been like militantly, I don't play video games. It's just not true. But my last like three computers have had integrated graphics card because like I used to buy the top of the line computer so that I could do anything on it. And that didn't really like, I appreciated it and the computers lasted a long time, but if I was honest with myself, I never used them to their full potential. So I decided I'd buy computers that I knew I was going to use everything on. So like I upgrade the processor like crazy, but I don't really use the graphics card. Oh, now I'm like coming back around. Like I should have gotten a graphics card. So I think that the total cost of ownership for a really nice Oculus Rift level device is going to be kind of a steep purchase for me. So A, it means I have to save for it, so I'm not, you know, so I can act like a mature adult. Because those sorts of things just not healthy to do impulsively.
That's true. I'm going to wait until they port over Second Life, and then I'll be in.
Oh, man. And then, yeah, and the other thing is I want some actual titles. I want some games to play. And, you know, to me, if I can just watch movies, I think that's a good enough, like, use. Because I love, like, really immersive 3D movies. That sounds awesome. I'm super stoked. But you know, unless there's a couple of games that I can share with my friends and stuff, I don't, you know, it's good. But so they won. Congratulations. Go Oculus Rift. They're becoming they're slowly becoming my new darling sweetheart company. But the other one, and this just seems like cheating. Like I understand why you have to include this company in this competition, in this part of the, in this category, but it's like you don't let anybody else compete. How about you just like walk away from it? But Kickstarter won the Crunchy for best overall startup.
I got a Kickstarter project on my wrist.
Almost everybody that was competing was a Kickstarter project. Like Oculus Rift was a Kickstarter project. Actually, it's funny. What I thought was really interesting was that a couple of the – it's actually its biggest like competitors like GoPro and stuff were not Kickstarter projects. But you're like, yeah, I mean – you are giving awards for startups. The guys that make startups, I could see how they would have a leg up in that particular competition.
They created a very cool platform.
Oh, I mean, it's brilliant. I think they absolutely deserve it. I mean, I guess why I'm making fun of it is because they so clearly deserve it that it's a joke that you even ask the question. It's brilliantly powerful, and the very fact that the Crunchies exist and all of the projects that are shown on it are, you know, Kickstarter type. You know, they're either Kickstarter type projects or they're actually Kickstarter projects. That fact alone tells me that, you know, yeah, it absolutely deserves this. It is as awesome as it sounds. And, you know, at this point, I'm waiting on one more Kickstarter project. And, you know, coincidentally, no, I'm waiting on two more. But the one that's going to come last, just from the time frame of it all, definitely the one I invested in first. but Parallela is getting their act together, and they're actually going to deliver it to me, which is a better place than they were in November of last year. They completely run out of money.
Oops.
Which is a bummer because it's a really cool product, and I was like, and they basically, you know, actual development cost. They basically sold them for the cost for a little bit under what they'll sell them in the end, which I don't think they expected that to happen. And so they needed some more money to kind of, you know, keep it going. But so they got some big investors. It's a good company. That's awesome.
Yeah. It's just
congratulations.
Yeah. And I think Kickstarter is just a super interesting platform. It's just one of those, like, the rules, they were working on it, and then they had a law change that just the timing couldn't have been more perfect, to where you just go, oh, duh.
Yep, what was the law that changed?
They changed how you could receive funding. It was all about the funding and investment laws and stuff. And I mean, and they were already working on ways to get around it. And they just, you know, they came in and really, I don't remember it exactly because I'm not a lawyer and I really don't care that much. But it was, what in the world is going on over there?
I don't know. I can't even tell that anything's wrong.
Okay. And that law changed and the timing was really well for them, and which is another reason why a bunch of those peer-to-peer lending things are now popping up. That was semi-related to that, and just the crowdfunding changes. But yeah, a brilliant idea. It was good. We weren't all really sure if it was going to work or not, because you know it was kind of like, can they get enough traffic to get the funding that these companies need? And they got lucky in the sense that a couple really cool projects decided to try them out. Because I, you know, on one level you're like, what's the risk? Let's go for it. You know,
so right.
Hebble was obviously a huge influencer on that. Which at the time, I remember reading an article where everyone was like, Pebble's amazing. It's the next big thing. Which it is cool. Don't get me wrong. And Pebble Steel is pretty awesome. But. I remember reading someone was like, no, Pebble's not the story here.
Yeah.
They go, they're a symptom of what's happening here. And they're like, Kickstarter's the story. And so, yeah, I'm with you. They totally deserve the award.
Right.
If they ever go, it'd be weird if they ever go public. I guess you can invest in it, but it's weird.
Yeah. But well, yeah, anyways. It's funny. This is off topic. I don't have the article, but it's, you know, talking about all this. GoPro is going to IPO soon. They just announced they're going to IPO soon, right? And and why do you IPO? There's one or two reasons. You're either Facebook and you're paying off your early investors, or yep. You know, generally the reason you do it is because you're raising capital for something.
Right.
And, you know, what would Kickstarter raise capital for at this point? I mean, they're doing crazy good. And I'm sure, yeah, that would be weird, but it's, you know, it's...
Well, it might be they want to scale their services. They want to add
yes.
You know, something else to it, to where, like, you can imagine they create an entire back-end platform to help startups be successful.
Yeah, that's,
you know,
a good
where
point.
Instead of going to like the new Disney Accelerator or something like that, you go, well, yeah, we're going to do Kickstarter, we're going to get the funding, and then Kickstarter's got resources to help us actually, you know, now that you have $1 million, here's what to look out for, you know, and you know what I mean, and like and people to help out. So I could see that. I could see them wanting to expand internationally as well, kind of tap into the old Chinese marketplace, and that would require some capital to be able to do that. So there's always reasons to get money, and I can see a couple easy ones with them, but I don't think they're going to do it anytime soon. I think they're still just kind of riding the wave and trying to figure out what we have.
One of the things that I love about that, what you just described, though, is the fact that it's a company that built a platform so you can fund projects. So basically, you're buying stock to give them money so they can fund projects. I mean, that's it's such a, you know, such a nesting doll of of this one idea.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know. They're awesome. I love Kickstarter. I spend way more time than I should, you know, surfing their projects. Don't tell my boss.
That's cool. With the eventual hope of spending money on projects, right?
Yeah.
At least that's their goal.
Yeah, well, and I would say way too often I spend money. Yeah, sorry, did I just...
And so I'd like to transition to a new way, a new secure way to pay.
Oh, baby.
I got a new credit card, or a you know, not a new one, but a refreshed one. You know, when it expires and they send you a new one, whatever that correct term is. I got one of those in the mail. I'm going to conveniently cover up some numbers here.
Say.
But it's can you see that gold chip thing that's sitting
there? I recognize that. You want to know why I recognize that?
Because you got one too?
No, because I spend way too much time in Europe.
Ah, yes, that's right. That little gold chip, which at first I was like, I don't know what that is. And in it, they gave a description, and they were like, yeah, it's for when you travel abroad. This thing is useful because you can type in your PIN, to which I have no clue where that piece of paper went, so that's awesome. And because I haven't used it in the United States, but that's all going to change, and I'll have to find that PIN number. Because those are what's called a smart credit card, kind of. Smart in the sense that they are invented and in 1992 in France, and they haven't come out to the U.S. yet. So the way that the current system works is you got a credit card and you swipe it, and then depending on the company and the size of the expense, you then sign something, right? If you go to my local donut shop, even if you spend $2, they make you sign for it. If you go to Home Depot, it's only expenses over $20 or $50 they make you sign for it. I sign a lot at Home Depot, unfortunately. Yeah, and so the problem with that is that it uses the magnetic strip, and then it's just you're signing either a digital thing or a piece of paper, and it's relatively easy to commit fraud with that system.
Right.
And one of the biggest examples of that was the recent Target fiasco, I think is the right word for that, you know, where the 40 million customer credit card details were, you know, exposed. And that was actually, I think, the tipping point for Congress to say, you know what, I think it's time for us to adopt this European model, which is more secure. They were saying that the United States accounts for a quarter of all transactions worldwide, but has 50% of the fraud worldwide.
I believe it.
So that's just statistically significantly higher.
Yeah.
And they were saying, which I'm like, good, I'm glad they're being consistent. When France did roll this out, they saw their fraud drop 50% the very next year. I'm like, okay, math is consistent.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So the big difference is, again, it's this this little whatever that thing is called.
Smart chip.
Smart chip, thank you. Actually acts like an ATM PIN type thing, so it's encrypted and can actually change numbers on the fly depending on the transaction type that you're doing. And so there's that. And then there's a sign and swipe and then a PIN and swipe. And so, you know, the one model is you still sign it, so at least the transaction itself is encrypted, making it harder to you know, to take customer credit card details. And then the other one is a PIN, which is just like a debit card or an ATM card where you have a four digit number that you also have to code in. And so the idea being, you know, A, first you got to have this card that's encrypted, so it's hard to duplicate. And then B, you have to physically be there. And then, you know, C, you know, you have to know the PIN. So, like, it's just significantly more secure to do that.
Yeah.
And like I said, Europe's been doing it for a while. And the United States has finally said, or Visa and MasterCard have finally agreed with the United States, that by 2015, those will all be in use. Those smart cards will all be in use in the United States. So it's coming. Mm-hmm.
What I think is really interesting.
Go ahead.
All right. So what I think is really one of the things I think is interesting is that one of the biggest problems with it is that the fact that they're like the cards cost more to make, but it's not a very significant increase in cost. Obviously, any like a cent and a half per card for, you know, 100 million, you know, 300 million Americans is a significant amount of money, but it's, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, eh, over the time of the, you know, you do some things that kind of like balance it out. It's not that big of a deal. It's not billions of dollars. It's hundreds of thousands of dollars. It's not going to end the companies to do this. But their argument has always been, why would we do this? Why would we take on the expense of making the more expensive cars and building this infrastructure when nobody's going to upgrade their card readers because they're way more expensive?
So,
that is the billions of dollars of infrastructure, you know, cost that really makes it cost prohibitive.
Yeah. So there's two thoughts to that. So part of this deadline is something that they're going to have what's called liability shift. It's going to happen. And essentially it means whenever a card fraud happens, they'll determine who, you know, they need to determine who's liable for the cost, okay?
Right.
And so what'll happen is that if there is an incident, whichever party has the lesser technology will bear the liability.
Interesting.
So that's the big change in 2015, and that's the incentive for folks, for companies to upgrade. And what I find is interesting is they were interviewing people and they're like, yeah, we've got a multi-year rollout plan in order to do it. Cause like you said, it is genuinely expensive and we're like, dude, you have like less than it. Well, I guess it's October of 2015. So they've got a little over a year to do it. Okay. Like a year and a half to do it. And, multi-year is longer than a year and a half. You know that, right? And, you know, but part of it's like, yeah, we don't have a choice. And I would imagine some of those are fairly low risk as well. And then I was talking with he's a manager, VP or something important for a local bank here. And he was talking about their ATM machines. And he goes, yeah, we're deciding to take them all out. And his reason, he goes, you know, we've done the stats and they're expensive to maintain and to keep up.
Is it a bank taking out their ATM machines?
This is a bank. It's a local bank. I mean, they're not a national bank.
Right.
They're still got a few dozen branches. And he goes, but what they found is because of the type of bank they are, he goes, we like customers to come into the branch and create a relationship and stuff like that. And he goes, but then even with the bigger ones, it's like, they've got apps now. You're not going to go to an ATM to deposit a check. You're just going to take a picture and be done. And so he was like, so they're not getting used as much. And he goes, and then plus, because of this rule, I forget the number that he put out there. It was either 50,000 or 500,000. I mean, like, and I think it was closer to the 500,000. He's like, that's how much it would cost us to upgrade all of our machines to do it. And he's like,
that's a lot.
So we just won't.
This could be. Wait a second. Go on.
Yeah. So I was just saying, you know, so I think a lot of companies will make that choice too, where they go, yeah, you know what? I don't know. I don't know how Square works or how they can make this work, but that might be where a lot of companies go, you know what? This is a great time to switch over to that because of those types of costs.
This may be one of the greatest coup d'etats that's ever happened. I am like super stoked about this because this
Bitcoin
is like,
Bitcoin's just going to come right in. Not that they're secure at all, apparently.
No. Well, it's funny. They're amazingly secure. So I'm just going to touch on this really, really super quickly. You know, like, cause this week, you know, the big announced Silk Road 2 got hacked and people lost thousands and thousands of Bitcoins. And everybody's like, oh, see, Bitcoin's not that secure. And everybody's like, hey, Bitcoin is secure. The Silk Road 2 wasn't secure. And as people are like actually like looking at it more and more and like kind of studying what's going on, like bank accounts are still being drained. The staff at Silk Road 2 are like not responding and everything. And everybody thinks that the guys that Silk Road 2 is basically a massive scam. Set up the thing and then get, you know, billions of or get millions of dollars in Bitcoins in and then just cash out, steal them all. So Bitcoin is secure. It's the websites that you use that can be insecure. But that wasn't actually my point was going to be. Basically, what's going to happen, this is what's going on. This is just crazy. I'm super stoked on this, right? The biggest argument for why e-wallets weren't practical is because the question has always been, how do you build the infrastructure for it? Phone has your money on it. How do you get it from your phone to somebody else's phone? And so everybody's been trying to create these really these low friction methods of doing it, whether it's the near field of communication on your Android phone, or whether it's Bluetooth with your iPhone. And so all these different things, these like really low cost thing, the low cost methods, put it in everybody's hands. Apple's plan is so transparent at this point, it's not even funny. Put it the system into every device, so everybody that has an iPad now has a money collection unit for iPhones, and because it's all on the open Bluetooth protocol, it works for Android too. It's like crazy. This is awesome. And this is like so clearly what's going on with Apple, and all of a sudden what you're going to do is you're going to force everybody in the entire nation in a 2-year period to upgrade to some sort of a new financial transaction thing. They're going to build Bluetooth. All they have to do is build Bluetooth and an NFC chip into every single one that they sell of these, and you will completely remake how we do financial transactions in America in a way that.
The question is, do you think that'll happen fast enough, or do you think that so you're a company and you're going to go, well, whatever Europe's using, we'll just buy that existing product because it's
right.
Cheap.
See, that's the question that this is the difficult part. Yeah, because it's like the timing, it's either going to be the biggest fizzle of all time, or it's going to be the greatest coup d'etat. Because it's exactly it. Can Apple in, the next 4 months, really and truly, when iOS 7 or 8 come or whatever we're going to be on, 8 comes out, can they announce their e-wallet in enough time and get people excited enough and basically start this conversation of this is a secure way to do financial transactions? Because if they wait till iOS 9, till 2015 to do this, they're going to completely miss the boat. And the worst part about it is now everybody will have already bought their new card reader and nobody will want to reinvest. Not only will you have missed a golden opportunity,
right,
but it will close the opportunities that were already there. It's going to be worse for adoption of e-wallets.
Yeah.
It's one of those things where credit card companies, MasterCard and Visa card might get relegated back to like, I don't even know what they would be doing. Literally, because they make all their money off of you swiping your card. And if they can get circumnavigated because,
Well, you'll still be using a credit card attached to that e-wallet, so they'll still have that.
Yeah, I guess. Well, maybe. I mean, you assume that, but why can't I just attach my bank account to my iPhone and go drink? PayPal effectively does that. PayPal's
But I mean, that's the same as a debit card, right? And
right. Well,
I just.
Why can't Capital One give me an account number that syncs to my, assuming I go through the ridiculously high interest rates of Capital One. why can't they, or why can't Bank of America just give me my credit line number that's not attached to a Visa credit card that goes through my iPhone? And, I think early on, the first stages of all of this, you're going to go through Visa, MasterCard, because it's easy and it's comfortable, and that's kind of how Apple rolls. They want things that seem easy and comfortable. But, long term, and when I say long term, I mean 5 to 10 years long term. Why would I still be using a credit card? What's the real advantage there other than them taking a little cut at it every time I use it? And, especially as a big company like, let's say McDonald's, McDaniels, they've got to upgrade all of their systems, right? Okay, we got to do this. We're going to put Bluetooth in it and we're going to make it compatible with the iPhone, iWallet, and whatever, Android's compatible, system that they come up with. And then they go, and every time you swipe your credit card, every time you use your credit card, we're paying 2 cents to Visa or MasterCard. I'll tell you all what, if you use something that doesn't require us to use your Visa or MasterCard, but just goes through the phone, we'll give you, 2 cent discount on your meal. And then, and just get people in the habit of, not using that. Maybe there's a possibility.
I'm going to be the Debbie Downer and say it's not going to happen. But
saying. I mean, like, it's one of those things. I was going to say I don't know enough.
Theoretically, yes, it could. I don't think it will.
I don't know enough of the financial back end to know really. I mean, obviously, you know, Visa, MasterCard are like the, you know, kings of, you know, that, yeah. And they might be so instrumental in the backbone of financial transactions in America that it's laughable to suggest that they wouldn't be necessary at this point. You know, they might be like the telecoms where they're just, you know, they're just there and you'd never get rid of them. They are. And if you tried to get rid of them, you'd crush your own ability to spend money. So I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. You know, are they, but, that actually would be interesting to look into. I probably will, but this is the makings. If the tech companies can get on their game, this is the makings for some really radical changes in just how we all treat technology, which is exciting. And I like it. And if nothing else, we actually get to have, you know, more secure credit cards, and they won't look at me like I'm a freak when I walk into a pub in England with a swipe credit card. And they'll be like, I don't know how to take your money. Just please take my money. I don't care how you figure out how to do it. Just take it. That's what happens every time. Actually, the really other interesting thing is they legally cannot take your credit card out of your sight when you go to a restaurant. They all like these wireless card swipers that they bring to your table as opposed to like taking your credit card to the back. They're not legally allowed to take it out of your sight, so they can't steal your numbers, which is really smart. Don't know why that's not a law in America.
Kind of paranoid, but I just like the idea of them using the card. I think we should just all restaurants should invest in the Microsoft Surface. So all you do is put your card on the table. You can flick your bills around, put your card on the table, pay, done, move on.
Exactly. So,
or they should treat it more like a hotel or something where when you make your reservation, they get your card real quick and they swipe it.
Right, exactly.
And anyways.
So what do we want to let's do this. Big announcement.
Let's do can we do the big one?
Yeah, that's what I was gonna say.
The timing is good from a cut standpoint.
Perfect. And actually this is the one I want to talk about. So
all right, let's do it.
It's kind of a big deal. This is a big deal. I'm gonna cut off the legs of this conversation before we even get started. That I have no expectation that this will get cleared by the SEC or whoever makes these decisions.
SEC or something.
Who makes decisions on antitrust stuff with telecoms? I don't even know.
It's going to be.
Who said AT&T can't buy T-Mobile? Thank you, by the way. I really appreciate it. Somebody who's getting ready to jump over to T-Mobile.
Man, where is it? This article doesn't actually say. I don't know. It's one of those guys. Regulators. Let's go random, you know, or general.
There we go. So American regulators, I have no expectation that they'll let Comcast buy Time Warner. But Comcast is going to buy Time Warner.
But
That's so on Wednesday, it leaked that they were going to announce that they were going to buy it. And then on Thursday, they announced we're going to buy them. It is a $45 billion customer. But it will bring 30 million customers. Did I say a deal? It's a $45 billion deal that will bring 30 million customers under one leaky roof.
Yay
for the free market.
Scales of economy.
Yeah.
It is the FCC, by the way.
Is it? Okay.
And the Justice Department.
Yeah, that's the JD, man. Those are my boys. They're gonna back me up.
But they're pretty sure they're going to let it go.
Really? Why did they say that?
Three big reasons. one of them you'll just roll your eyes at. First one, this is not that one, is that it's only a $44 million deal. It's really not that big in the grand scheme of things. I mean, it's big, don't get me wrong, but it's not like – it's not ginormous.
Right.
So there's the one. Two – Oh, I love it. Comcast and Time Warner have actually done a pretty good job of carving up the United States, so there actually is very little, if any, overlap between the two. If you have Comcast, you probably do not have an option for Time Warner cable. And so they're like, so you still only have one choice. It doesn't actually change a competitive landscape. And number three, the one where you roll your eyes at, both Comcast and Time Warner have a ginormous, huge lobbying presence there. And the Comcast, one of their board of directors guys, is the former head of the FCC. So I knew you'd roll your eyes to that one. So they're like, yeah, it's going to go through.
That's super annoying. I love the fact that...
So, I mean, obviously, you know, the dance has to happen, of course. And they said, and plus Comcast can do certain things. They can play the games where they say, hey, in anticipation of this deal, we were able to lower everybody's prices by 5% because we were able to take advantage of economies of scale. You're welcome, America. So it's going to happen. I mean, I'm fairly certain I'll be shocked, let me put it that way, if it doesn't go through.
That's not what I wanted to hear, James.
I know. I'm sorry. But and I said it and you went, dang it, he's right. Ah!
I'm like super depressed now.
You know, it's funny. So I have talked about it, and I just haven't done it yet because I've been super busy and now's not a great time to do it. Of course, I don't know when it is a great time to switch internet providers, but I haven't. And I've been thinking about switching over to Comcast because they are faster and probably going to guess a little bit more reliable, blah, blah, blah. And it was kind of like after reading this, I'm like, man, do I want to?
Yeah, all you have to do is give up customer service.
Well, if I were being honest, that's not giving up much at this rate. I'll say it. I'm with CenturyLink. They're bad. They're not fantastic. I don't know how you do it well, honestly, but.
Well, okay. I mean, you know, I hate to be, you know, that guy, but you know, letting companies compete in the free market is not a terrible way to allow competition to, you know, drive service up and prices down. But you know, when you've got
I'm with you, man. There really isn't competition to begin with, and so to paraphrase a great galactic princess, Google Fiber, you're our only hope.
Yeah, I know. It drives me nuts because it's, you know,
And it was interesting. I was reading this article by Om Malik of Giga Om. He founded it, which is why his name's in it, which is kind of cool.
You know what I love about Giga Om, James? Is it literally every time you bring up a Giga Om article, you explain that.
I know. That's because I just think it's that awesome.
I know. That's what I like about it. Go for it, man. This is the last time I'll bring it up and make it awkward.
Nah. You can do it more. It's okay. His whole thing, he goes, look, this isn't about cable. Don't even think so. He was showing some revenue numbers about, you know, the triple play between cable, internet, and telephone.
Yeah.
And so he was saying that voice revenues are, you know, will go up by $6 billion. You know,
that's a lot.
Comcast's voice revenues, you know, they're taking on an additional $6 billion. Does that make sense?
Seems worth it. $45 billion over six, you know, divided by six.
Yeah, sure.
It's not too bad. It's like 8 years.
They were saying that – I got to make sure I'm getting my numbers right here. Broadband – yeah, am I doing this right?
Oh.
Yeah, I know. The broadband will go up about $17 billion for Comcast. And then I can't even remember where the cable one was. But it wasn't very much. And he was showing some charts that were showing the growth of those. And surprise, surprise, phone is going down. You know, they're not gaining a lot of subscribers. As a matter of fact, they're losing more than they're gaining, which it makes sense to me intuitively. You look at the cable, it is flattened out. And then you look at, you know, broadband, and that's just rocket to the moon type stuff. Big steady growth. And so their whole thing was like, you know, don't worry about cable. That's not a big deal. Well, you know, we've got ways to get around that.
Right.
You know, to cut the cord. They're like, but unfortunately, you got to keep the broadband cord going in order to, you know, get rid of cable. And they're like, and that's their play. And they want to be a huge player there. And by getting control now, they can control that pipe. They can do some net neutrality stuff. They can implement data caps. They can, like you said, get rid of that competition so that, you know, they can dictate how people will use it. And already infuriating, they were comparing speeds and prices to other countries around the world, and we are significantly slower and significantly more expensive than anyone else. And that's just the way it is, and it will probably only get worse now.
Yeah, and it, I mean, it just is, you know, it's just super crazy because, you know, what drives me nuts is, the fact that it's like, so one of the articles that I was reading is basically like talking about why this is terrible news and who's this bad news for? And one of the things that's like, indisputable, it's demonstrably true, is that Comcast is throttling Netflix and Apple data. You know, if you've got an Apple TV, and this is specifically true for me, we use Comcast, and every once in a while I can tell that the network is heavy and they're punishing me because I have an Apple TV and I'm watching Netflix on it. It's just like, it's indisputable. You know, my internet's dragging down because I'm streaming Netflix on my Apple TV, and they know, you know, they know what that signal looks like, and they look for it and they throttle it. And it's just like, I hate you so much, so much. And the worst part is that Netflix and Apple get blamed for it a lot of times, just like Google gets blamed when it takes forever for YouTube to buffer. Now, there are some things that Google's doing with the YouTube player that's absolutely their fault and just, you know, in a pathetic disregard for the product that they're serving up to people, specifically when you scroll around and it, you know, if you go backwards in time on your player and it forgets everything that's already loaded, it just drives, what's the point of buffering if you're not going to remember what you already buffered? But you know, the reality of it is that, like, you know, slow buffering is not necessarily their fault at all. A lot of that is just, you know, they're looking for that data and they're, you know, they're jumping on it. And this is, you know, it's only going to get worse because this is what it's all about. Like you said, it's about controlling the pipes. And, you know, and it's funny, like, and you know, obviously with, like, Verizon a couple of weeks ago, you know, they did that lawsuit and they tried to, you know, knock down the whole net neutrality thing, and by and large were successful. And the courts, the reason why they said the reason why the courts sided with Verizon is because they said there's legitimately competition. If you don't like Verizon, you can go with AT&T or T-Mobile or Sprint or MetroPCS or, you know, Straight Talk. There are other options for your service. There's, you know, you can't say it's anti-competitive and they have a monopoly if they're not being anti-competitive and they don't have a monopoly, which to everybody's response was like, well, that's ridiculous. Like, you know, they're clearly, you know, messing with us and colluding. Can't that be enough? Like, and
I can't remember if you shared this article. If I did, I actually don't remember reading it, so it was probably you. But they had a conference call when they were, you know, when they were announcing it, and David Cohen, who's an executive there, he gave this quote where they were like, which just sums it up exactly.
Yeah.
They were asking about whether or not, you know, this would lead to some relief for customers who are tired of seeing their monthly bills continually going upward. He goes, the impact on customer bills is always hard to quantify.
Yeah.
We're certainly not promising that customer bills are going to go down or even increase less rapidly.
Like
you were talking about, could you imagine if AT&T had said that? Oh my gosh, that would be
competition. Right, and when you actually put it in contrast, you feel like we all feel like we're getting raked over the coals with Verizon and AT&T because you don't feel like you have a choice. And then when you put it in contrast to what's going on with Comcast, Time Warner, you're like, wow, okay, you know what? I'm actually they took a lot of my hatred for AT&T went down a few notches. Now My love for T-Mobile went up a few notches, but, you know, I grass always green on the other side of the fence, you know, that sort of thing. And that's what I'm saying. You keep that green grass for me, T-Mobile. I'll be there soon. But
so here's the question. Here's the question, Matthew.
Yeah. Okay.
I realize that what we do right now is super important, but I would argue that it is not a utility yet. So the question is, how do we create a utility that everybody needs, and we're the only ones who can give it? Because that seems to be a pretty cool place to be. I'll be honest.
I'll be totally honest, James. I spend an hour forcing myself to think about that regularly. I'd say at least once a month, I will force myself to just walk around and try to think of what is the next utility. Because what is the next product that you can sell to people that will become indispensable? Because, yeah, I mean, I would love to become a public – I'd love to build a company that delivers a public utility and become highly regulated, because they're all stupid rich. They're all stupid rich, and they're hated and they're despised and just stupid rich. You know, and you know, power companies, you know, gas, and you know, gas companies, water companies, public utilities, man, that is the place to be. If you can get there and you can destroy all competition, legalized regulated monopolies are a beautiful thing, man, if you can be on top of it. And I don't know if, and it, honestly, I would gladly say it on this show if I could come up conceivably with one thing that I could say would be this definitely a public utility. This would be one day we can make this a public utility. And to me, it's funny. I think clearly what's going on is, you know, these companies are becoming public utilities, all of them, and they need to be regulated with, you know, it's a pretty rough shot, because the problem is that, you know, this whole net neutrality thing is, it's interesting. Some of my favorite political thinkers, I agree with them on literally every point, and then we start talking about the internet, and it's just like, you guys are clearly morons. Like, what the heck is wrong with you people? Like, you know, it's just, you know, and it's funny, like, Supreme Court lawyers drive me nuts, because the Supreme Court lawyers that I listen to, that I read, that I love, and I agree with them on everything, and then you hear them talk about the internet, and it's just like, what is wrong with you people? Like, you know, and let me just, like, you know, and you know, not to get into,
do you have an example? Because I mean, I just don't.
Yeah. So, you know, we don't talk about politics too much on this show, and hopefully revealing a little bit of my politics won't make anybody, you know, decide to walk away from it. But Tim Sandiford of the Pacific Legal Foundation is a guy that I think is great. He gets interviewed a lot in one of my favorite talk shows, and I've read one of his books. He's just a huge, like, individual rights advocate, and for the purpose of financial betterment. It's like he fights the EPA, you know, in the Supreme Court, in order to protect people, like, from getting deprived of everything they've owned and worked for, because the EPA is just writing, like, crazy legislation all over the place. And, you know, he's a big advocate for fighting for the little guy's ability to prosper. You know, and obviously, you know, if the EPA's, you know, if they're legitimately poisoning the environment, he doesn't protect them. He protects people who, like, aren't doing anything crazy. It's just, they're just running roughshod of overregulation by the EPA, and the EPA's coming down with, you know, million, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of fines and taking your house.
All right.
So, you know, this is the kind of guy.
Really, you care about the internet part.
I gotta say,
what does he say about that?
So this is the guy that's coming, and then his like response to it is like, you know, to the internet is basically saying, like, no, like, this whole net neutrality thing where the government's getting involved in regulating these companies and telling them that they're not allowed to sell to who they want when they want, that's how you destroy competition, that's how you drive up prices, that's how you ruin prosperity. And I'm like, what? are you serious? Are you not watching what these companies are doing? They're clearly colluding and working, like, against us. Like, they're anytime they've been given money, like, when you look at, you know, government has given them money to build better fiber optic cable, you know, networks and stuff, better telecommunications, to improve our overall broadband, average broadband, and nothing came of it other than the enrichment of these, like, of these CEOs. And there's nothing you could do about it because you don't have any options. They've got legalized monopolies all over the place, and they just, they abuse us like crazy, and they collude behind doors. It's just like, at some point they become an electric, you know, but his opinion is that they're not a utility. They're, you know, if they're not a, yeah, you got to regulate, you know, power companies because they're a utility, but the internet's not a utility. So the best thing to do is to let competition, you know, competition will give the best, you know, results. And it's like, okay, as somebody who, yeah, like,
they're just not,
I know. Yeah. There's no competition. And like, you know, maybe it's just because I live in the Silicon Valley, but I don't know. It's important to my economy. It's a utility to me, you know?
So is there a way to increase competition?
I
you know, instead of going down the regulation route, can you say, okay, fine, you know, maybe we don't want to go there. Is there a way to increase competition?
I think what you got to do is you got to make it so that I think what you have to do, honestly, is I think the right thing to do is to say that the person who owns the pipes cannot, you know, I don't know. It's like, okay, what's going on with T-Mobile right now is pretty cool, right? They build a few access points, and then they buy all of the rest of their access from AT&T. So you get all the coverage that AT&T has, but, you know, just slower because they buy it wholesale. I think companies like Comcast, Time Warner need to be able, you know, have to charge fair market prices to sell it wholesale. And you got to give, you know, you got to make it so that all that if you own a cable, you got to let, you know, some podunk little whoever, you know, run on that cable just as fast as your data. And that means that you also have to, you got to treat the actual hard lines as though A, they're dumb pipes, and B, they're, you know, they're public utilities. And what that means is that, you know, yeah, they're going to get a little, they're going to get a small cut out of everything that they do, you know, and in order to upkeep the infrastructure.
Okay.
But, you know, but they want to own everything from the content that's going over it. They want to own the contracts because they want the vertical integration so that they can have a complete monopoly over content delivery, because then they can charge whatever they want and they make all the money. But if they have to charge, you know, if they have to give, you know, no precedence to their content, if they can't, you know, throttle Netflix and, you know, furlough and furlough bros, you know, delivery system, you know, we're able to get the exact same price, you know, as Comcast, you know, and maybe even, you know, but, you know, we do something, I don't know, you know, we give a, if you watch the Furlough Bros Tech podcast, we give you a discount on your internet. We pay fair market prices to Comcast, but we get more users because, you know, we're charging less because we're subsidizing it with the Furlough Bro podcast and all the, you know, oodles of money we're making on this. All of a sudden, Furlough Bros is getting good content. We're happy. Comcast is happy. When I say you got to make a public utilities, that's what I mean. And it's, you know, and you know, that's what we do with the electric grid. If you're a power plant and you put money onto the, you know, onto the grid, you know, especially in California, PG&E, Pacific Gas and Electric, you know, you basically, you deal with them. And it's really simple. If you have solar panels on your house and you make more power than you need, you put power onto the grid and PG&E pays you. They own the grid. They own the power distribution system and they make tons of money doing it. But yet you have an opportunity to put money out there. As an individual, you can buy power from specific sources. If you want to be green, you can buy money from green productions, you know, stuff. Now, granted, all you're doing is buying money from the open grid, or buying the power from the open grid, which means, you know, some of the electrons are coming from coal power, but all the money you're paying is going to green power sources, which effectively means over time, you know, more and more green companies become, you know, there's incentive. They're incentivized to build more power supply. And all they're doing is supplying to an open grid, and you're pulling from the open grid. But, and, you know, and Pacific Gas and Electric gets to make, you know, a little bit of money in between, which is fair. They upkeep the thing, but they're forced, they're legally forced to be fair about it. And there's absolutely no reason why the internet infrastructure can't work like that. I don't understand, you know, well, I do understand why it can't. It's because Comcast makes an unbelievable amount of money by not, you know, being treated like that. Where PG&E makes crazy money, Comcast makes, you know, just despicable money. because, because, you know, they get to charge more. Oh, you want power from green? Well, that costs twice as much to make, and then we're going to charge twice as much on top of that because we don't like them. They're not us. So, you know, yeah, you could have them, but you're going to pay four times as much, you know, and they just make it, you know, prohibitive for anybody else to compete. And the worst part about it is it's what they're doing with the content. I don't know. I to me, it just seems so clear. And then on the other side of it, and it's like, the worst part is all their comments about how people don't want, you know, high speed internet. And you
what?
Got, yeah, no,
who are
I
these
know,
people?
I know exactly. This is the same week that Google is announcing that they're planning, they are promising to start delivering 10 gigabyte per second internet, which is,
I saw that,
literally 10,000 times faster than our parents' broadband, because they get 1 to 2 megs. It's just like, it's freaking nuts. You know, yeah, exactly. I mean, like, and that's, I mean, it's just like, that's insane. That's just insane. It's insane how fast the internet's going. And then on top of that, IBM Labs broke a speed record, or announced that they broke a speed record. They're talking about being able to get data speeds, low energy data transmission, up to 400 gigabytes per second. 400. I mean, and you know, and that's up and down time. That's not just, I mean, it's just, it's crazy. All these leaps and bounds. We have pathetic internet compared to other countries in the world. And it's funny. I heard all of these different rationales and like engineering, like explanations for why our infrastructure cannot handle what other countries can handle. You know, everything from, you know, overall closeness to, you know, the backbone of our internet is XY. It's older technology because we built it earlier. They got to leapfrog us, so they've got better this, they got better that. And it's funny, the more and more research I do, the more and more it becomes, you know, painfully obvious that any limitations that our infrastructure has, A, is by and large, it's not as bad as we are paying for. You know, it's the infrastructure is not as weak as they pretend it is in order to charge us more for less. And B, any weaknesses it does have should have been taken care of when we gave them billions and billions and billions of dollars to upgrade that infrastructure out of taxpayer money. You know, and you're like, and to enrich these companies, it drives me nuts. It absolutely drives me nuts. We're getting raked over the coal so bad on these with these companies, and you know, and they're regional monopolies. They're states, cities, and you know, counties that have, you know, basically, you know, and the very fact that Time Warner and Comcast have virtually no overlap, they have virtually no competition, is just the two biggest companies. How does that not just inherently, you know, I don't know. I think what's going to happen, I think the FCC is finally getting their act together. I don't, you know, and this current administration has another 3 years. It's entirely possible that they'll actually get their act together enough to really enact some serious, you know, net neutrality stuff where they treat internet provision like it were data line provision. You know, on the flip side though, that has, you know, this whole smart grid technology, the electrical smart grid is, you know, that's obviously where we need to go as a country, and we're not doing it because there's not a lot of money in it and there's not a lot of competition to push for it. You know, and so it's, you know, it's not like it's, you know, it's not like it's a perfect system by any means, but the current system is not working. You know, something needs to be done. Now, this is something, doesn't necessarily need to be done, but something needs to be done because it's not working. It's just not working. You look anywhere else in the world, and when we're clearly getting beat, and it will hurt us as a country and as individuals.
Wow. You have an opinion on this.
Yeah, it drives me nuts. Obviously.
All right. Well, I'm going to let you cool off a little bit. Wow. Well, we'll see what happens. Maybe we'll get lucky and it won't go through, but I'm not going to hold my breath.
Yeah, I'm going to say thanks for crushing my
hopes and dreams.
And maybe
I should start applying for some Comcast jobs, it sounds like, too.
Yeah, seriously. That's,
if I can't beat them, join them.
Mm-hmm. There's a part of me that wants, you know, there's a part of me that thinks like that, too.
But, yeah. either that or figure out how to, like, how do I just get, how do we do this over, you know, the T-Mobile network or something.
Yeah.
That's how we really stick to the man.
Yeah.
We're just really switching over to a different man. Okay. Let's see here. I want to learn about wireless power.
So this is pretty awesome. I'm a big fan of your wireless transmission. Obviously, if you listen to this show at all, I think battery technology is a big deal. And this week, some big things are happening. State of the technology, real quick. Basically, you know, most wireless power is like, basically you got a little pad, you set your phone on it, and it charges it. And it all works over essentially the same principle. What you do is you take a magnetic field, and they call it, there's strong magnetic coupling. You take a coil and it generates an alternating magnetic field. If you put another coil in that field, it starts causing electrons in its coil to start, you know, get all excited in a very similar path, you know, in a similar way without actually connecting the wires. So there's no physical touching. They're just magnetic fields, you know, moving together. This is actually how transformers work, which is why I'm going to Spain to replace one.
Those kind of transformers. Got it.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And
first I was like, wait, I don't get the connection, but I'm with you now.
Yeah. Electrical transformers. It's funny. Everybody I talk to is, you're going to go replace a transformer in Spain. That's awesome.
That's
not
so
as cool
amazing.
As it sounds. Yeah.
I love that job.
I mean, I hear you say it's cool. I think it's awesome.
Out how to shop some of that stuff ahead of time for when you're there.
Yeah.
So you're just like working on a transformer. It's just like a big bumblebee cutout.
Exactly.
That would be pretty funny.
That would be pretty funny.
Confuse a lot of people. But it'd be funny.
What I love about it is it's even like the like really non-nerdy girls that never watch Transformers that are like the robots? No. And like that's
that, yes, exactly. Actually, am I cooler now?
Yeah, exactly. No.
You find me attractive.
Well, the best part about it is I just love how pervasive that, you know, Transformers are in pop culture. That even the people that don't care about them care about them. That type of power transmission allows you to cut the wires. It's pretty exciting. There's a really cool MIT demonstration. If you go watch a TED Talk, there was a company that they figured out what they call weak magnetic coupling through magnetic resonance, which is effectively what they were saying is what you can do close up through strong magnetic coupling. You put one coil right next to the other coil. We can do over a long distance, which is like, you know, up to like 5-10 feet at this point. And we can power stuff way across. The thing is that essentially what happens is you have a transmitting antenna and a receiving antenna, and they have to be really, really fine tuned to each other in order to work. So everybody was coming out with their own way of doing it, because there's a lot of options. There are benefits and faults to all of them, but nobody was coming up with a standard. So effectively what you were having was a proliferation of different charging options. But it was like all the cables back in the day. Every phone had a different cable. They all do basically the same thing, but they all do it a little bit differently, so you have to buy their specific cable. And it was really kind of cutting the legs out from underneath the industry because everybody had standardized on the really effective, easy USB, except Apple. And because everybody was standardizing, it's like, you know, who wants to go out and buy a pad that's not going to work for all their phones? Well, good news. Basically, these companies are realizing that that's the problem right now, breaking into the market in a big way. And so they're all starting to agree on standards. So Qualcomm and Samsung joined forces to start the Alliance of Wireless Power, A4WP, one of many organizations competing to establish the universal standard for wireless charging. Obviously, Qualcomm and Samsung, big deals. Apple hasn't thrown their hat in openly with anybody, but it's pretty obvious that they're trying to. This is huge. And they all kind of, you know, like your Samsung Galaxy S's, And Qualcomm's in every phone. So they're really focusing on the strong magnetic coupling, the short range stuff. So you have one pad, you plug into the wall, you throw any device on it, your watch, your phone, whatever, automatically charges. It's, you know, it's rotation independent, or you can do all sorts of cool things. And, and more and more people are getting crazy with like what you do once you have a standard.
Cool.
Yeah, it's really cool. It's very exciting for this kind of technology. But the big deal and the reason I got super stoked is because I've been waiting for this. Like, I decided about 6 months to a year ago that I thought that TED Talk where they were talking about the long distance power transmission, there was something wrong that they weren't telling us, because I hadn't heard anything from them. Like, I literally hadn't heard anything from the company in forever. And they had always stated that they weren't going to sell, they weren't going to sell aftermarket stuff. They were going to sell their patents essentially directly to OEMs. But I hadn't heard anything about them until this week. And all of a sudden, in 2011, Y-Tricity announced a partnership that will see its contact list long field magnetic resonance used to power up Toyotas. This is 2011, obviously, with the new partnership plans to innovate on the incorporation A4WP's with this new specification. So basically, they've just agreed to throw in with A4WP, this Samsung and Qualcomm, cool, which is great news, because in my opinion, if their technology delivers on the promise that it is, it's the way everybody's going to have. But it requires some like real infrastructure changes, because like they build these, their antennas are larger, and you're going to have more of them in your house. But you can embed them in walls and charge entire rooms. Like, you just have your entire room become, you walk into the room and your phone starts charging. Or your foot wash that you never take off your arm starts charging when you're home or in your bed. And they basically just blanket places with these, these power chargers.
Yeah.
In my humble opinion, that's the way that it needs to go. And you're finally getting some real big dogs all together and agreeing, yeah, we're going to make this work. We're going to standardize on these technologies. And, cool. It's super exciting. We've yet to see a
that's
real
kind of thing that, like, man, that'd be so cool. It would semi-solve the battery problem, which would be nice. I mean, like, imagine installing this in airports.
Yeah. Well, if it were like Wi-Fi, it would be like Wi-Fi. It would just would be McDaniel's would build this into all of their tables so that you could just you're hungry? You need some free internet and some free power? Come on in. We'll help you out. They already got wall outlets everywhere. Why not put these in everywhere? And if there's nothing in the field pulling down the power, they're not very inefficient. They're like a wall wart just plugged in. Yeah, they suck drain a little bit of energy, but it's not that big of a deal. These are things that companies that are already offering, and they're not huge expenses, additional expenses. Think about, oh my gosh, I mean, like, how much more would somebody – how much more annoying would Starbucks be if all you had to do is walk in with your, MacBook Air to work on your, manuscript, and you don't even need to bring your power, and you got internet and, power. You just sit in and you could sit there for days. That would be, sipping on your mochaccino. That's where this goes. I mean, and if everybody
and
is
– And it's safe so far, as far as I know. For
sure.
Humans to be exposed to it long term,
dude, it's as safe as putting a phone antenna up to your brain, which some argue is not safe. But it was one of those things where, people freak out about it, and it's entirely possible that this is making water troughs out of lead pipes, AKA a la ancient Rome. We're all slowly poisoning ourselves to death. It's possible, but a lot of people are studying it hardcore, and nobody's coming out with any concerns. You know, it's magnetic radiation, which, if you're freaked out about magnetic radiation, turn off all light everywhere, because guess what that is? And, you know, it's just that it's, you know, that stuff can be really deadly in two forms: incredibly intense amounts of magnetic radiation, and be highly tuned magnetic radiation. But we're particularly badly tuned for this type of magnetic radiation. So even at really high, you know, energy levels, it's relatively ineffectual on us, which is comforting. Yeah. So it's, you know, I don't know. It's cool. It's really cool. It's really exciting. And I get stoked on this kind of stuff because, you know, I think that this is clearly, the future of power in America and, you know,
the power. I like it. That's cool. The future. How far off is that future?
You know, 10 or 20 years. I think so CES this year was a big deal because some of these certifications are finally getting like approved by other companies and like, you know, any products. So realistically, I think within 2 to 5 years, you'll start to see consumer. I think Samsung is going to get on this bandwagon fast because they want everybody to buy Samsung charging stations, and just they want to rule that market. That they're very interested in that. Qualcomm doesn't want any. They're just doing gangbusters right now in the mobile wireless industry, and so they don't want someone like Intel or Texas Instruments to see an opening here and cut them off of the lake. So they're both very, 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 very interested in setting the standard and getting it out there in as many phones as quickly as possible. So I think realistically, in 2 to 5 years. It'll be really common for all non-iPhones to have some sort of a standard charging station where this stuff is built in. And it'll be interesting to see what Apple does, because this is the sort of thing where sometimes they strike out on their own and decide to be rebels, but sometimes they decide to, you know, just they realize where it's going and they jump on the bandwagon faster than anybody. And it just
partially depend if they think they've got a better solution or not.
Right. And I think, you know, I think the iWatch, you know, my gut is that they want that to be some sort of, I don't know. I keep thinking they want everything to be wireless power every time, and every time it's not. So I can't tell what their wireless battery ambitions are at all. Like, I'm so out of tune with them, it's not even funny on this point, because I think it's like the only thing that matters. And they're like, chillax, we're working on it. Like, come on, guys. Or not. You can't tell. That's the whole point.
Just stay tuned for great things. We got great products coming out.
I know, right? Jeez.
That's what Cook says every single time.
Every single time. I actually believe him this year, unlike last year where I called out that they're coming out with the iWatch this year, just unquestionably. Sure. No. Have you seen the team that they've put together?
Yeah,
it's crazy.
A couple years to go, right?
No.
They're just putting the team together.
I've watched this enough times. Okay,
I know. No, they're going to. He just says the exact same thing every single time.
It's super obnoxious. Yeah, you know,
anytime someone asks him for some sort of insight, he has none.
Yeah, I know, and it's not because he has none. It's just because he's, you know, loose lips sink ships, and he's a classically trained Jobsian.
Well, Jobs shared stuff. Jobs was a better discerner of what can I share and what can't I share. And
right, exactly.
He doesn't know, and so his default is nothing.
Right, exactly. Well, and oftentimes Steve Jobs would like, you know, nobody reads anymore months before they launch iBooks. He had no qualms misdirecting, I think is the word that he would use. Lying. But, you know, and I say all this to say, because this is what drives me nuts. So the iWatch, you know, I'll jump ship. The team that they're putting together, they are putting together a hardcore team, yes. And everybody's talking about all the cool new stuff. They think that the iWatch is going to have what they call optoelectronics, which are basically just LEDs with LED sensors. But what's cool is if you blast LED into the skin, you can see what's going on in the blood. And so you can monitor things like oxygen level, in levels in the blood. You can monitor heart rate and stuff. So basically have this thing on your wrist and it'll give you all sorts of important vitals. Problem that I have with all of this.
The heart rate monitor is the last thing I would like to have, and I don't.
Yeah, me too. That's a big selling point for me. My problem is that this is a classic Apple. They put together what they thought was essential hardware. Good battery life, looks beautiful, has a, you know, Bluetooth and a pedometer. And then once they had the product together and they really knew what they were going to do, then they hired all the experts on medical, you know, stuff and to start developing on the medical stuff. Problem is, the final design for the first generation is probably already relatively set.
Yep.
And so all this hiring they're doing is for the next generation of it's
definitely
the second generation of iWatch, which drives me nuts because it's going to come out. I'm going to want it crazy and know that it's only a quarter of what I want and that the next year's version is going to have everything I want. And you don't want to know what the worst part about all this is? I'm still going to buy it because I'm like just so stoked on it. Well, maybe not. If all it is is a really good looking Bluetooth pedometer, I'm not buying one. I like my Fitbit just fine. But that's not all it's going to be. It's going to have other cool
things. It'll also tell time.
I don't know, right?
Watch. You'll be able to control your music. That'll be cool.
Yeah, but I am.
I know. I'm harassing you.
I know you are. It drives me crazy because it's, you know, there's a part of me that's like, yeah, it would be nice. I would like that.
It is nice.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, geez. Hey, we'll see. We'll see what happens here. It's too, way too difficult at this point to tell exactly what's going to be in it, other than it's going to be awesome and, you know, it's a medical device. That's so clearly what it is. I mean, there's a huge medical team. And it's exciting because it's like, you know, where Google's out hiring all sorts of like crazy, like, you know, deep learning experts and stuff and, you know, roboticists, and everybody's like, you know, look at all this, like, you know, innovation that's going on in Google with all the purchases and hirings they're making it. Like, that is true. But let's not like underestimate the team that, you know, Apple's putting together, and they're building one of the like greatest healthcare team, you know, medical device engineers that it, you know, is on planet Earth. And medical device engineers are generally relatively small teams. You only need, you know, like 30 engineers. They've got like a team of like 100 of some of the smartest, like, you know, most degreed guys. They are putting together a just tank of an engineering and scientist team to work on this product. They are very, very, very serious about it, and they want it to be. They want everybody to need one, and I think they're going to do all right in that capacity. But I'm excited to see what they come out with.
I can tell.
So speaking of
one
putting
more
together. Oh, geez, I get one more.
Choices.
I know. This one's cool. If you're not from the Silicon Valley, you probably don't care much. If you are, you probably already know. But I'm going to talk about it anyways because I think it's cool. So Moffett Field. You know the hangar at Moffett Field? This is like, especially for our family, this one's kind of a big deal because our grandfather worked for Lockheed Martin. A couple of our aunts and uncles worked for Lockheed Martin. And one of our cousins currently working for Lockheed Martin. So we got three generations of, they wanted me to work there so bad they couldn't stand it, or at least apply. And I was just like,
I applied for a couple jobs.
It's boring.
They didn't want me. Lost, Lockheed. I hate you.
Yeah, pretty much. But you know, right next door, one of the if you're coming up 101 on your way to San Francisco from Santa Clara, so you're like the heart of the Silicon Valley. Like this is what the Silicon Valley is all about. As you're coming up, you know, passing Lockheed Martin, there's this big old hangar that's just been there forever. It's an airship hangar, and it's right out Moffett Field. It's gigantic. And
did they give you any like like how many football fields it is or anything like that?
I'm not in this article.
Okay. I'll look it up. You keep talking. I'll look it up.
Yes, thank you. Because I was starting it. So basically, what happened was this gigantic hangar that they're building that they've had there forever. NASA uses it used that field for a long time. They don't use it that much anymore. It just kind of sits there. It's basically a private airport designed for military and government test stuff. Well, they haven't been doing anything with it. And if you're familiar with the area geographically, not only is Lockheed Martin's headquarters right there, but so is Google's, like, right next door. They're basically down the street from each other. Facebook's a little bit higher north. Apple's a little bit lower south. They're all within a 15-minute drive from each other, which just weirds me out and is kind of amazing. The heart of the internet happens here. But the Google guys, because they're so close to Moffett Field, they're like, hey, NASA, mind if we park our planes there? So all their private, like, charter jets that they all the execs get because they're crazy, stupid, rich, they park there. They don't park it at. I am flying to Spain. I have to fly out of SFO like a plebeian. They park at Moffett Field with their, like, super awesome jets and stuff. Well, they've been using it more than NASA, like, a lot more than NASA, and they've been paying tons to NASA. And they were like, you mind if we just, like, I don't know, buy it from you? And NASA was like, I don't think we can go that far, but you can lease it from us. Mm. So they've worked out a lease agreement where basically Google's taking over Moffett Field. NASA still gets to use it if they need it for any of their cool, you know, we're going to Mars testing. And they were like, and because, you know, the hangar at Moffett Field is part of the history of the Silicon Valley, of the Bay Area. Y'all got to keep it. And Google was like, of course we're going to keep it, man. We're going to restore it. So Google is, as part of their lease, have agreed to restore the hangar, which it's amazing because it's enormous, but it is old and decrepit. And there have been arguments about whether or not they should refurbish it or tear it down for the last two decades.
So this thing is, so I got the stats on it.
Awesome.
It is, 1,133 feet long by 308 feet wide. That translates into 6 football fields.
Woo!
I love it. Wikipedia actually used that as a descriptor to tell you how big it is. I was like, yes! It just makes sense. Those doors weigh about 500 tons.
Oh my gosh.
That's a lot. And, they have 150 horsepower motors to
open them inches at, you know, per minute. I mean, they're moving super slow. If you're on the Google right now, you're on your computer, use your internet connection and Google hangar at Moffett Field and just look at the pictures. This thing.
How about this one? The airship's hangar's interior is so large that fog sometimes forms near the ceiling.
Oh my gosh, it's awesome.
A person unaccustomed to its vastness is susceptible to optical disorientation. Looking across its deck, planes and tractors look like toys. Along its length, maintenance shops, inspection laboratories, and offices help keep the hangar busy. Looking up, there's a network of catwalks for access to all parts of the structure that can be seen. And there's 2 elevators, I guess, that meet at the top, allowing maintenance personnel to move. Yeah, that's pretty. It's not small. It's the largest in the world, by the way.
It's obvious when you drive by it. It's just ridiculous. I've ever told you that my
it's a 60. It's a what is it? It's a how tall is it? The shell claim doors. It doesn't say how tall it is. I wish it did. It's tall.
Yeah.
At least 10 feet tall.
At least, at the very least. One of the things that
It looks taller than it is wide, and we know that it's 308 feet wide. My guess is it's probably like 300 to 350 feet tall.
Yeah, which is, you know, by the way, a football field.
There you go.
It's the thing is just ginormous. I love it. Have I ever told you that one of my dreams is I want to own a farm on the coast of California, just like one of like the cliff farms like that looks over the Pacific Ocean. Beautiful. I want one of those so bad I can't stand it. But the other thing that I want when I'm like super rich, I want to buy a hangar and like build a house inside the hangar and like build your own weather systems in it. So if you want rain, turn the rain on. If you want, like, sun, like, it's obviously going to be an expensive project, but you can, like, build your own, like, ecodome inside of a hangar. Like, it sounds so, I want it to be, like, giant tree forest type stuff, like, all over the place. Like, you know, you just, like, build, like, have, like, trees grow in it and have stuff, like, hang from the ceiling so, like, you can, like, walk up catwalks and, like, be over, you know, like, over your house. And because you can build, like, full-size giant houses inside hangars. And they are, you know, like, dwarfed by the hangar. I mean, they're awesome. They're great structures. I love them. I'm going to have to be really, really, really stupid rich in order to make this happen. But I'm
working on it. You better come up with that utility idea quick.
Right. Right? Exactly. But
though, if you figure out how to control the weather inside of that dome, you may be onto something already.
Good point.
I like it. That's pretty cool. That's cool. I mean,
I agree. I'm very excited about it, obviously.
Cool. I like it. Let's see here. Where are we at? Okay. So, hey, thanks for doing this Saturday morning. I appreciate it.
Thank you for doing it Saturday morning, because you're welcome. Spain.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're leaving today, coming back Tuesday.
Wednesday.
Wednesday. It was a Wednesday.
Okay. Yeah.
All right. That'll be good. You're gonna work hard. Kind of a whirlwind. How long is the flight? That's what
it's. It's 12 hours to France. About an hour and a half from France to Bilbao. So total travel time is going to be probably 16 hours.
Well, that's not awesome, but that's not horrible either.
Honestly, I've done the layovers in Montreal and New York, and those are way worse because it doesn't doing a direct, you know, slowing down, landing, doing the transfer and everything, like, adds so much time to it. But also, just, you get off of a 10-hour flight and you get back onto a 10-hour flight, and it's awful.
Yeah,
it's that second leg, you're just like, I can't believe I'm doing this again. Please stop this. Can we just be done? Whereas, you know, Kevin, to get onto an hour and a half of, like, puddle jump across the, you know, a European border, it's not bad. I can deal with that.
It's still kind of fun because you're like, I'm in Europe.
Right, and I get the French stamp in my passport, which means technically I've been to France, and then I'll have a bunch of pictures of me in Spain, which means I've technically been to Spain. So I get to add that one to my list as well, although it's kind of a stretch.
Yeah, that's a little bit. Yeah, I gotcha. What was I going to ask? I can't remember, but oh well. So that's cool, 16 hours of travel.
I don't know.
That's a lot.
I'll get there at 3 in the afternoon in Bilbao, Spain.
Oh, that'd be perfect. Get a couple hours of work done, you'll be good to go.
Well, since it'll be Sunday, I get to party, man. Okay. And the best part about all this is my phone is officially unlocked, so I can buy a SIM card there for the 3 days I'll be there. I might do it just for the fun of it if it's not too expensive.
Right. That's sweet, man. That's cool.
Yeah, very cool. I'm very excited.
Yeah, that'll be good. All right. Well, I'm going to let you finish packing.
Thank you.
And I got stuff I'm doing, so there we go. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. I am James Furlow, and my what are you?
I went with Valentine Love Struck. Yeah,
my
Cupid.
Love.
You go for it.
What would I call you?
Don't worry about it, James.
Spanish love struck brother is Matthew Furlow, and so we will talk next time.
Thank you.